Welcome back to our deep dive with Thomas Worthland McConkie, mindfulness teacher and researcher in the field of adult development. In this wide-ranging conversation, we explore how developmental stages are reflected in how we do things in the LDS Church. And we get an intimate glimpse into Thomas's experience as an outlier in a staunch and very prominent Mormon family.
So it was a vulnerable time. I was on pretty rough terms with a lot of the family. And then, you know, Apostle Granddad Worthen calls me downtown.
And so he reached out to you?
He did. He reached out, and he'd never done that. And he must have just intuited that I needed it, because it certainly wasn't a meeting like, I'm going to sit you down and I'm going to tell you how you need to be living, son. Mm-hmm. It was the opposite of that. It was this moment where he just sat down, had the most, just a presence like a lamb, that energy of you just sitting down with a lamb, and just said, I have absolute faith in you.
Join us for this fourth episode in our deep dive with Thomas McConkie. Welcome back, everyone. I'm here with the very handsome Thomas McConkie.
Why, thank you, Bill.
You guys will have to take my word for it. Otherwise, you'll just have to enjoy his mellifluous, calming tones during the conversation. So we're back. We're talking about waking up and growing up, basically. Is that a pretty good way to put it?
That's a good way to put it. I wonder if people listening know what you mean by waking up and growing up.
Well, we've talked a little bit about waking up, and we've talked about growing up in terms of development and waking up in terms of sort of a contemplative life that makes us more alive in the world. Is that a good way to say it?
I think so. And the way we talk about waking up and growing up in development, there may be the two primary axes of human development. As we understand them now, the two major domains of human growth and development are states, which refers to waking up, and stages, which refers to growing up. I think we're going to dive a lot into the growing up.
And when you say states, you're talking about sort of states of consciousness.
States of consciousness. Yeah. Christianity seems to be clearly associated with the emergence of a new kind of state of consciousness in the human family. For you listeners who maybe haven't delved into this territory, if you look historically at the, literary record of civilization, there's pretty good evidence that certain states of consciousness were, more commonly associated with different periods of history. It's as though the human body, mind itself were evolving, and as we evolve and grow, we develop the capacity to experience different states of consciousness more fully.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that, that more historical sweep in a later session, maybe our last session.
Okay, cool.
Christianity invites us to become children again, childlike. Mm. Sort of seeing the world with new eyes in some ways. Mm. And I wondered if you'd ever kind of link those ideas of waking up, which is kind of that's really what the Buddhist tradition is teaching, right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Buddhism, I think, is a great historical example of a world tradition that really gets waking up. Buddhism, by a lot of accounts, is the most comprehensive record as well as kind of training program to learn to do that.
Yeah.
But then in an area like, let's say, growing up, these stages of development, Buddhism, until the last few decades has been very silent on that.
Yeah, exactly. Didn't have a lot to offer. On the other hand, you might look at Mormonism. It's interesting because Buddhism and Mormonism, it seems to me, are two religions that seem to be growing. Mm. Of all the religions, religion seems to be in retreat everywhere, and Mormonism growing a little more modestly than we used to be growing, but growing nevertheless. Mm. And Buddhism is, at least Buddhist practice, is becoming very popular. Not Buddhism as a theology or religion per se, but Buddhist practice is becoming very popular throughout the West, throughout the United States.
Yeah, and tying it back to our conversation, I think a simple explanation for that, and we have to beware of any simple explanation, but one explanation for that is that Buddhist practice actually represents an opportunity to grow along a whole new dimension of, you know, human experience. And people love to grow. People are interested in, you know, who would I be if I grew a little more, if I expanded a little more and tapped into my potential a little more. And, you know, someone who's been practicing mindfulness for a couple decades now and worked with a lot of people in it, I can speak firsthand to the exhilarating sense of growth people get from a mindfulness practice.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we're both interested in importing a little of that technology into the native tradition. And yeah. I think Christianity and Mormonism has quite a bit to add to those traditions.
Yeah, well, I think it's this time in Earth's history is pregnant with that possibility. We have this now, this real encounter between East and West.
Absolutely.
That we'll probably talk about again in that maybe that last session. But yeah. It reminds me of going back 2,000 years ago when Christianity was sort of the emergence of these two forces. It came to be Athens and Jerusalem sort of coming together, these two traditions in a very rich way. And maybe there's something akin to that that's happening now in world history, where the world has shrunk and we are brought into community now with these other traditions, and something rich can probably emerge from that. So we'll talk about that later. But we want to talk about today more on a personal level, how this development, this growing up, what this looked like in your life. And I just want to kind of invite you. We had kind of in our previous sessions moved through this, you know, conformist and expert stages and discussed that in some detail and talked about how you kind of lived that in your life, how that manifests in your life, which was different than how it manifests in a typical Mormon life. But go on from there. Where are we? You're age 18 or 19 now. Tell a little bit more of your story there.
Well, yeah. So this may be some repeat, but at age 19, when I was 19 and 2 weeks old, I think it was after I turned 19 and didn't go on a mission and realized, you know, what a devastating decision that was on a lot of different levels. I've just felt like I needed to, you know, get out of town. And that kind of opened up a new phase in my life where I really intensely practiced. I was really religious about my Buddhist practice. I think I needed that handrail and I needed that grounding. And I just kind of bounced around the world, literally. I started in Los Angeles, then I moved out to New York. And once I figured out I could just show up in L.A. and New York and get a job and find a place, I thought, I'll maybe venture a little farther next time. And then I ventured to China. And it really just started this global tour. And I think meditation for me was the main theme in that tour, that I knew, I just had an intuition that meditation was really changing me. From like at the deepest level of who I was, that it was doing something good to me. It wasn't till years later that I realized in a developmental sense that I was also growing up. But certainly, you know, age 19, moved to China when I was 20, came back to finish my degree, my college degree in the States when I was 21, 22, 23. From a developmental standpoint, I look at this period as kind of my achiever years. And the reason I think about that, my life in terms of achiever years, is because I had chosen things that I really cared about personally, and nobody was specifically encouraging me to do it, to deepen in it, to become a master at it. But meditation was very much something I looked at as my trade. This is what I'm going to do. Not necessarily for a living. That came later just by accident, but it was something personally I felt invested in. So I really spent a lot of time meditating, and I learned more about it, and I got better at it. And as I was meditating, it was interesting. I was kind of a dropout student in high school. I was a swimmer, a water polo player, and hardly cracked a book through high school. But what was interesting is I meditated more. A lot of the mental emotional disturbance that I think prevailed in adolescence, it started to kind of clear up in my early 20s when I was back in college. So I really applied myself as a student for the first time, which is a real novelty to me. And I cared a lot about getting good grades. I cared a lot about learning everything there was to learn about English literature and postmodern literary theory, et cetera, et cetera. But, those college years, let's say 19 to 23, I think I was really, really giving myself fully to this kind of achiever way of being, which has a lot to do with starting to really examine personal values and charting a course, giving shape to a life that honors and pursues those values.
You had an interesting experience at some point here with your grandfather, Worthland, again.
Yeah.
Can you maybe tell a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, well,
I'll have a few questions about that.
Yeah, well, the experience with my granddad Worthland when I got back from China rocked my world. And it is a classic case of, when you experience development beyond your own ability to process, let's say when you encounter development that's more advanced, more mature than your own, it kind of leaves you staggering. You know something powerful happened, but you don't have the operating system to make sense of it. And mm-hmm. I had an experience like that where, I met my granddad downtown at the church office building. It was a really lonely time in my life still. I was 21 years old. I had hair down to my shoulders. I stuck out like a sore thumb. I had a little bit of a Chinese accent because I'd been living in China. It was painful awkwardness.
How'd you make it past the guards?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have to come to them and get you?
I had to show them my ID.
Okay.
That's Thomas Worthland right this way, sir. my friends were getting back from missions at that time, and I just was dying of envy because, they were it. They were what the culture was supposed to produce, is these men, these spiritually mature servants of the Lord. Right. And I was just some street rat out of China. It's kind of how I felt. And so it was a vulnerable time. I was on pretty rough terms with a lot of the family. And then, Apostle Granddad Worthen calls me downtown. And
so he reached out to you?
He did. He reached out, and he'd never done that. And he must have just intuited that I needed it, because it certainly wasn't a meeting like, I'm going to sit you down and I'm going to tell you how you need to be living, son. Mm-hmm. It was the opposite of that. It was this moment where he just sat down, had the most, just a presence like a lamb, that energy of you just sitting down with a lamb. And just said, I have absolute faith in you. And it totally jogged my circuits, because everything I knew cognitively said that I had screwed up and that, people around me were going to be upset with me and be judgmental of the life I was living. And there just was not even a trace of that. And I walked out pretty confused. And I remained confused for years. And I think even today, as I recount that story with you, I'm in a state of kind of divine confusion in the sense that I don't know how my granddad knew everything he did, how he intuited like what I needed just in that moment, but he showed up and he offered something that really cracked me open. And the world, whether in the way of a person or an experience, it plants seeds in us that maybe aren't ready to germinate for years and years. But certainly as I look back on that moment, I recognize really a power that my granddad was deeply plugged into.
Yeah.
And it's alluring.
A power to connect to someone who feels broken in some way and realize that you're not broken. You might feel broken, but yeah.
Right, yeah.
And so that faith was, how did that affect your height from that? Did you, as you looked forward, it was kind of confusing in some ways. It was not clear what that was going to look like.
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I'll skip ahead a few years here, but it's a nonlinear story in a nonlinear world. But I read an article in Sunstone. I was probably 20. It was probably 6 years after that meeting with my granddad. So 6 years later, I read this article in Sunstone that John Kessler had wrote. So John Kessler. He's as fine a Mormon mystic as we have. He wouldn't call himself that, but he's a very deep meditator and very realized in the waking up traditions. And he wrote this article.
Wonderful person.
Yeah, just a good
guy. Most unassuming. Jesus.
Yeah, he's a teacher to us all. Yeah. He wrote this article, and he talked about working with my granddad, Werthlin. Mm. John was legal counsel for the church in Europe. My granddad was an area authority. I was 4 years old at the time, I think, and when they were working together, but John Kessler wrote an article decades later about it, and he was reflecting on the spiritual qualities that my granddad had. And it's really funny, too. My granddad, if he were here, he would be smiling to this, but John is very plain in his article when he says, you know, Joseph Werthlin wasn't the quickest guy on his feet. He wasn't this razor-sharp intellect that's just pouncing on every
idea.
Even
though they call him Swifty. That was more a quality of his footwork than his...
That's because of his 40-yard sprint, exactly. but, you know, John's very, very candid about the fact that you wouldn't describe my granddad as this really smart, intellectually deft person. Mm-hmm. And yet, what John related in the article, he put words to something that was blowing my mind, something that was working on me, something that I'd experienced 6 years prior in the church office building. John actually put words to it. And the moment I saw it, I thought, that's it. That's what it was. And John said essentially that this guy who's not he's not the brightest light in the room. He's not dumb. It was just, he's intellectually, that's not where he shines. But where my granddad, I think, really had a gift was to just really submit to the Spirit mm-hmm. and let something deeper move through him that he himself couldn't intellectually understand.
Yeah.
Which is to say that when I was 21 years old, I don't know that my granddad knew he was doing me any particular favor. It certainly wasn't coming from this cognitive place like, you know, My grandson Thomas has been in China. He must feel lonely. I'm going to just put my arm around him. It was just coming from such a depth.
Just responding to that instinct that he had to reach out to you.
Yeah.
It's interesting that there's such a deep polarity involved in your own name.
Right.
Just Werthlin McConkie because...
Yeah, because people would describe Bruce that way.
Yeah.
Bruce was a staggering intellect.
Right.
John wrote about my granddad. I'm just going to back up here. John wrote about my granddad in Sunstone and just said, like, John said that he learned a lot from my granddad Werthlin about spiritual gifts and what it means to really be deep in the Spirit. And my granddad's certainly not the only example of that, but that's a personal family example where I made contact with that gift that changed my life. And when I read that article, the first thing I did was get in touch with John Kessler and, you know, kind of throw myself at his feet and say, I need to learn from you because you're describing something, you're clearly embodying something that is so at the edge of my awareness, I can just barely taste it with the tip of my tongue, and you're writing scholarly articles on it. And I mean, he's really an experienced person, but that was a turning point for me. I mean, that was really, I love that time in my life because this is at 27 years old, I felt this profound connection that I could totally give myself to with my granddad for the first time. I went from 13 years old, I want nothing to do with the church, the 20-year-old Buddhist rebel, came home, had that kind of moment with my granddad, like, what on earth just happened? But it was 27 years old, I could actually connect with something here is powerful, and I don't have to say no to it anymore. Mm. I can actually say yes to it and still have integrity and still honor all of my doubts and complexities and Eastern flavors, but there's something here that I would be totally impoverished if I didn't come back to.
Yeah. Some ability to reconnect with a perspective that you had not been able to embrace at all. So
right.
That's a developmental stage too, right?
Just being
able to.
Yeah. It's always developmental. I mean, development isn't everything, but everything is informed by development. Every experience we have in life, we're having it from a range of the stages of development, which kind of imbue the experiences we have with particular meanings and interpretations. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, at age 21, I was kind of in this phase like, I'm going to do what I do really well. And I was still pretty hardened toward the church. You know, I talked about age 21, coming back to college. Right after college, I moved to Spain, and I lived there for 2 years. And I think all the different perspectives happening in Spain, it really forced me to take different perspectives other than my own routinely, you know, just as a matter of course, throughout every day that I'm in a different language. I'm talking to people who have very different ideas about God and Christianity. I mean, Spain really exercised me that way, so that I think by the time, you know, after a couple of years in Spain, I went back to China after Spain and blah, blah, blah. I was always wandering. But by the time I was 27 and had that moment I described with John Kessler, there was something in me. It was nascent. It wasn't fully fledged, but it was this recognition that was actually quite earth-shattering to me at the time. It was recognizing, and I'll put this intentionally in developmental terms, but it was recognizing that all perspectives were true and partial.
Yeah.
Meaning that I had left something very true behind in my native tradition. And it didn't mean that it was all the truth. It didn't mean all the truth is under one umbrella. I don't think it's actually tenable to say that all the truth is in one spot. I think our theology really supports that, you know, we're continuing to learn about what's true. And
yeah,
it's a long process. But
despite the way we sometimes talk about it, which
yeah,
is...
Culturally, sometimes we maybe take liberties. Uh-huh. But when push comes to shove, I think we recognize there's a certain humility in recognizing that there's more to learn yet. And at age 27, that's when I got this glimpse, a really amazing kind of exhilarating glimpse that I can actually hold Mormonism again in my being, in my practice, in my life. And it can inform me. It actually has a perspective that's unique that I'm not going to find in Spain, that I'm not going to find in China. I won't find it in Catholicism. I won't find it in Buddhism. I'll find it here, you know. And that was really powerful for me. It was a major shift. And that points to, I think, the beginning of another stage that goes by different names. But it's a stage of integration. It's an integral stage where we start to have a felt sense of appreciation, just a native and natural sense of appreciation for all perspectives. It doesn't mean all perspectives are totally right. It doesn't mean all perspectives are equal. It means that we can actually put our mind into a given perspective and recognize that from that perspective, something important is revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed my life.
What name have you put to that stage?
Strategist is a common term for it.
What you identified as achiever stage, that when you learned how to sort of plan, look forward and plan a life for yourself, set goals.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of my family culture growing up. So I think I maybe... absorbed that stage or made that stage part of my life through my part of my adolescence and on my mission. Obviously, you're coming out of this intense expert stage we talked about earlier,
yeah.
But also seeing enough far enough down the road that you can start seeing how this how you can engage in the world.
Yeah,
and then after I returned from my mission, I was all about that. I mean, I was ready to hit the ground running. I was ready to, you know, get married, have a family, ready for school. I didn't have a clear sense of that, but I was able to. And it was in the context of my religious worldview, my social worldview, even my political worldview, which was strong in my family. So all of those things formed my worldview, and it was pretty clear how I could engage that overall worldview and just proceed in life. I do remember, though, one really kind of, you may find it amusing, but, I think I've told you this before. When I was not long off my mission, we had a very thoughtful stake president mm-hmm. who called a stake fireside, and he invited Dinosaur Jim Jensen. He was one of the most famous paleontologists in the United States, kind of trained at Harvard and then came to BYU and formed, in fact, all of the dinosaur bones you see down at BYU at the Paleontology Museum, which is impressive, down at BYU. Most of them he discovered, and his team discovered lots of new species of dinosaurs. So we're in this fireside and he's showing pictures of his discoveries and reconstructions of dinosaurs. And I'm like having this serious cognitive dissonance in the back of this chapel, and finally I couldn't hold it any longer. And when it came time for the questions, well, yeah, with questions and answers, I kind of said, look, how this doesn't fit with what we know about the history of the world given to us by Scripture. Mm-hmm. And so my tone is probably even almost accusatory. Mm-hmm. I just remember he looked at me. And he's like, and then I look at him, and then I'm looking up at his pictures of these dinosaur bones that he discovered. And I thought, oh man, I'm wrong. Like, mm-hmm. I have to find a way that, yeah, there it is right in front of me. Yeah. And he was, I'm sure he heard that question so many times before, and he answered in a very polite way, but moved on quickly to his dinosaurs, right? Yeah, which was what it was about. But that marked a shift.
Yep.
from that day I was exposed to a new perspective, and and that marked a period where something has to die, mm-hmm. in order for something else to come alive. Mm-hmm. And that's the time that I went to BYU, and I studied at BYU different perspectives, political perspectives, histories of different countries. I studied biology, so that's evolution. I learned about evolution. All of these things challenged my former worldview, but it was so exciting. Mm. I mean, it was really an exciting time. And it helped me, an old story that had ceased to work now in my new world gave way to something that was much more awe-inspiring, I guess, in a lot of ways. Uncertain also, because some certainty had to die along with that. But but something that what kind of gave birth, was given birth in that process, was very much alive to me.
Yeah.
So mapping back the developmental stages on my experience, what would you... And that's maybe a fair... Also, I have to say that some cherished religious beliefs... turned out to be baggage that I could no longer carry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nothing so fundamental as to make me give up my faith, of course, but things that had been part of my worldview.
Yeah.
Comment on... Maybe that's a little bit more of a conventional Mormon story, kind of... maybe you can...
Yeah, well, what's really interesting about that, I love that you can just reach back into your personal history and name a moment where something qualitatively shifted. It's a beautiful example of a developmental intuition. Yeah, I think we can all do this on a certain level. We can go back to moments in our lives where we know that we just didn't see the world the same anymore. And I think your story represents some complexity, because how old were you? You were a returned missionary?
21.
21. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So from a developmental point of view, what I'm hearing is that you were well into, you're talking about the expert stage, starting to peek into the achiever stage, which are rational stages where we use our minds to map the future and achieve the desired future that we want to work towards.
Yeah.
It sounds like that was really online for you. But what's interesting about development is we also talk about multiple intelligences and multiple lines of development. Mm. And we don't grow in an even way. We can have a very rational outlook on our career, maybe even on our love life or, something like that. But when it comes to religion, what I hear from your story is that you just kind of stumbled across this pocket of experience, of belief that you hadn't really rationally examined. And the moment Jim Henson, Dinosaur Jim, comes
Jensen.
Along. Thank you. How embarrassing.
Not the Muppets guy.
Sorry.
Although he's close.
I apologize to both doctors for that. So you see this evidence presented to you, and it's overwhelming. It's like, the dinosaur's really old. It's just clear to you. So what I hear happening is that little pocket of what we would call pre-rational belief, it's something you believe not because it makes rational sense, just because that's what people believe that you grew up with. That was just in the air. It was in the water.
Yeah, but also through that expert stage, you made it make sense.
That's right.
I made it make sense.
No, that's true. At the expert stage, you do as much as you can to say, well, God could have put 2 million-year-old bones on the earth when he created the world 6,000 years ago. You start to rationalize. You start to try to make these things work together.
Right.
And you're describing a moment where you just surrendered, like, it's just a lot easier to just call the bones old.
Yeah.
It's a developmental moment for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Really cool. I love that story. It makes me wonder, like, who the next Dinosaur Jim in my life will be.
Ah.
Because we all, like, Dinosaur Jim is always around the corner for all of us, always. There's some person, there's some source of information right around the corner that presents something to us that's deeper and truer and more beautiful. And we feel that yielding in ourselves, like, I just surrender to this truth and this beauty. It's, you know, I give up my old way of being to this. Yeah. That can be incredibly painful sometimes.
And yeah, kind of difficult. I think I'm always reminded in these moments of the Plato's cave allegory, right? So you've got people, it represents all of us sitting in a cave with our backs to some source of dim light, projecting. And what you've got is you've got myth makers and teachers and authority figures projecting images on the back of the cave sort of from behind you. And and so that becomes sort of your narrative, your worldview.
Right.
And at some point, somebody, and for me, maybe it was Dinosaur Jim Jensen, somebody says, you know what, I'm going to help you understand something. And it turns you around and coaxes you up out of the cave. And when you get up out of the cave, what Plato says, like, first of all, that bright sun is blinding. You have to, there's a time when you have to get used to it. That's not a comfortable thing.
Right.
It's not easy to get out of the cave, and then it's not comfortable facing the sunlight when you get there.
Right.
But it's a whole new experience of life. It's like, oh, wow.
It's a whole new experience, and I would suggest, I haven't read Plato's Cave since college, so I haven't pored over the text recently, but I imagine Plato might be sympathetic to what I'm about to say. That blinding outside light, that's also a cave. That's just the next cave. It seems really bright until 10 years later. It's like, man, I can't.
Then the next stage.
I don't even have enough light to read this book I'm trying to read right now on this light. I mean, there's no end to the caves we discover and the shadows that we believe in and then don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure Plato would agree with your amendment to his cave allegory.
Yeah.
There's no way to know for sure.
I'm sure if
someday.
If Dinosaur Jim were here, if Plato were here, if my granddad were here, they would agree with every word I'm saying.
So we're talking about these developmental growth stages from the standpoint of an individual. They also have implications for groups and even institutions like the church, which we're going to circle back to. But just from that individual standpoint again, maybe walk us, we've walked through this progression now from very early childhood through this conformist stage, and then through the expert stage, and then through the achiever stage, and then to the what's called an individualist stage. Just just give us a little kind of a walkthrough of what those stages are and what they look like. And then we want to get to some really interesting questions.
Bill's got some gotcha questions for me. He's going to corner me with these.
Don't think I don't.
A little bit about the individualist stage. Well, it's interesting. So just briefly, if we look at the achiever stage, and we're not trying to be exhaustive here, but to just paint a little bit of a picture, a lot of what the church does as an institution is informed by the achiever stage. When we come up with plans to home teach and to reach out to less active members and to send missionaries into the field worldwide and to have, you know, a systematic approach to, you know, offering discussions, inviting people to pray and read the Book of Mormon and timelines and goals. That, I mean, it's a world that's very much informed by the achiever stage. And every stage, it has its incredible gifts and benefits, and it has its drawbacks and potential pitfalls. So, you know, that could be a discussion in and of itself, but I just wanted to kind of start the conversation there that when I look around me, I see a lot of the achiever motivations and values in the church right now.
Yeah.
So, and it's an interesting question. As far as I'm concerned, that's right on time. You know, it's just a developing institution, organization, organism. What I do see evidence of is these later stages starting to emerge, even if in kind of inchoate ways, not fully formed, not fully developed, but certainly evidence of it. So when we talk about individualist, something, just a quality of individualist, this stage of development, we start in in research, we call this context aware. Context aware means that I'm aware of these different perspectives now. Every new context brings a new kind of knowledge, a new kind of information. And I get really curious about all this new knowledge, all these different perspectives. So how does that play out at a 3-hour block? Well, what I see evidence of is just the desire to do more personal storytelling, right? I don't want to hear from the manual. I don't want to hear from a teacher with all the knowledge. I want to just get close and personal with every person in this room, hear their story, feel their story. And I want to listen to their story so deeply that it teaches me something about who I am. Because I can't be complete without, you know, these different people and all of this different experience and all the different ways they see so beautifully.
Yeah.
Like, we've all had that experience. There's that kook who wears a plaid shirt, a checkered shirt instead of a white shirt, right, in our class. And you know, he or she, they're inviting this intimate space where just all about this subtle connection of, you know, we start to sense into a shared humanity at this stage. We're less concerned about dress, physical appearance, even beliefs. We're excited by diversity. The idea being that, you know, I'm really enlivened by diversity. Yeah. I hear a different perspective, and rather than recoil from it, I say, that's part of the community. I need to know that and hear that and feel that.
Yeah, we just had our state president in a recent adult meeting basically say just that. We need to get beyond the way we're teaching and the way we're meeting, and we need to talk. We need to share perspectives on things and sometimes ask difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're not doing that is inhibiting our growth. He was very brave, I thought, in saying that. And but it goes to your gospel doctrine teacher in your ward, right?
I was till I moved. I'm in a new ward now.
Oh, that's right. You just moved. Yeah, oh, right. Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
You can still refer to me as a gospel doctrine teacher, though, Bill. I'm okay with that.
Okay. Although maybe you shouldn't be. Because I got thinking about just the name of that class is interesting. It almost reflects a previous stage of development that it seems like we've moved past.
Oh, yeah.
Why do we still call it gospel doctrine class?
Right.
I mean, I would think we'd move to a point where we could call it gospel understanding, or even maybe how about growth in the growing in the gospel class,
right,
because
absolutely.
That's what we do too much of, it seems, and it reflects an earlier stage of development is abstracting, taking these ideas, the gospel ideas, and taking them out from between us and putting them up on a board and discussing them like they're some, like they become almost an abstract principle, and you try to tie it back to experience in some way.
Yeah.
But it's never a good substitute for actually connecting with a real person.
Yeah.
Because gospel principles are always about a relationship in the moment, right?
Like
the moment we're having right now, we could put that up on a board, and we could diagram what that looks like if we wanted to not have this experience together.
Yeah.
But and that would be so there's like this. We're very good at abstracting and making things if we talk about faith, we can define faith.
Yeah.
And
you can hear where Bill falls on the spectrum
here. I'm sorry.
You can tell how he feels about principles. No, it's beautifully illustrated that, like, when we get to a certain point in development, doctrine seems a little bit still. What you said, I think, is gorgeous. It's so indicative of this new wave, just natural wave of evolution in our church, that no principle, no doctrine will ever substitute this direct heart connection, being in presence with another being who is, by the way, on their way to becoming a God.
Yeah.
There's no substitute for that.
Or with God, him or herself, right?
Whether
you're identifying with Heavenly Father, Heavenly Mother, that direct relationship. There's nothing you can say about it that ever captures what it is. And we talk in church, and we often experience the divine, but it seems like we need to, it seems like we're at a point now where home teaching is another one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just the name of the program, and Elder Holland brought this up, I think, in a couple of conferences ago. Maybe it's time to rename this program.
Yeah, there you go.
We're not going to each other's house and presenting a lesson is not what it's about.
Totally. So gospel doctrine, I love this example. If we upshift it to a new stage, I don't want to talk about gospel doctrine. I want to talk about perspectives on the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear from everyone in the room, and, you know, no one's right or wrong. It's just, that's how they feel about it. That's more in the individualist kind of spirit of approaching the gospel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So are we should we shift gears about and talk a little bit about how we gather?
Let's do it.
We're
already doing it.
Yeah.
It's happening.
There's no, yeah. It was supposed to be later in our conversation, but it strikes me that people are less and less satisfied, and particularly a new generation of Mormons, with kind of how we gather.
Right.
And how would you characterize how we gather? And so because for a lot of us, it's just how we've always done it. What else would you do? And you sort of model something quite different in what you do in the secular community.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about that.
Yeah, well, you know, and even not in the secular community, but when I used to teach gospel doctrine at my old ward, I would really intentionally look at the stages of development and how they inform different ways of gathering. And my experience at church is that the kind of default is to, you know, you have a teacher at the front of the classroom, and they have the knowledge often. Mm-hmm. This is a generalization here, but this is the way a stage will play out. And it's the teacher's job to kind of dispense correct knowledge, to teach doctrine based on scripture. That's the value. And it's valuable. You know, we need to include that. But what I would do, I would notice that some people in the class, percentage-wise, certain people in the class, like, that's perfect. I don't want any more. I don't want any less. That's what I want every Sunday until I die.
Right.
And then you have other people just like on their iPhones, just like, seriously? I've been coming to church for 20 years. I've done this same lesson 20 times. And, you know, I'm doing time right now at church. Mm-hmm. I'm not growing. And so I would really intentionally jostle that space, and I would set up something that's much more informed by, like, the achiever mode. So what's different as we get into this achiever stage is that we're a little more interested in controversy. We're a little more interested in polemic and debate. We want to disagree a little bit and, like, look at each other. Like, you have your version of the facts. I've got my version. Let's see which facts are actually the facts. So there's room to, like, kind of scrap a little bit. Whereas before achiever, at expert, at diplomat, it's like, this is the law. Mm-hmm. If you disagree with the law.
The problem with doing that in a class is you make the conformists and the experts very uncomfortable.
Exactly.
Or a little uncomfortable. Sort of like dragging them.
That's right.
And there's also the element which we know is that some people don't come to church to be disrupted. Their week does that well enough. What they want from church is comfort in a world that seems very uncertain. They want a little certainty in their life. And so there's that need that's actually being met by church at some level.
Absolutely.
So it's not an easy question, is it?
It's not. And it's, you know, you make a good point that a collective, we tend to think about a room full of people as a room full of individuals. That's just developmentally we're primed to think that way. Right. But really a collective, it's also its own organism.
Yes.
Like a collective is just, it's a whole. And you can only move the whole along. You can only move as a group in one particular direction so quickly before the whole thing splits or ruptures or implodes. So in a gospel doctrine class, you have to really pace the whole. If there's a single person in a Sunday school who's more traditional, and you're trying to bring in this individualist sensibility of everybody has a voice, I'm not going to shut anyone down. Oh, you know, you're in favor of, you know, LGBT marriage in the church. Oh, and you feel that's evil. Can we still be a community and hold that in a room? I mean, it gets intense, and you have to really be sensitive to what a given group can tolerate.
Yeah, so teaching takes on a whole level of responsibility and right. skillfulness.
That's right,
in that kind of a context.
Right, because we don't just grow individually. Every individual has his or her own salvation to work out, or their salvation to work out, depending on, you know.
There's something physically about the way we gather too, though. And typically in meetings, you got someone at the front, and then you got rows of people. Mm-hmm. You can hide in rows. You only see the back of the heads of the person in front of the people mm-hmm. in front of you. You have to turn around to see people behind you. Mm-hmm. You can sort of peripherally see the people next to you,
right.
But you know, it's like this almost this classroom kind of engagement.
Yep.
I think if our churches were configured for this sort of thing, smaller rooms where you could actually be in circles.
Yep.
I learned this from 12-step meetings that honesty and vulnerability and real sharing occurs in circles.
And that's the classic individualist structure. It's not just individualist, but at individualist as a stage. That's where it's like, if it's not a circle, if we're sitting in rows, I don't know if I'm going to be back here next Sunday because it's just not intimate enough.
It's not intimate enough.
Straight up.
And we need intimacy. We have a society that's just woefully lacking now in connection and intimacy.
I actually heard a leader. Were you there? I don't know. You reminded me there was a church leader. Not like an apostle, but I was at a meeting and they made this remark, like, it's easier to get sex at a park than a hug at church.
Well, we got to put it.
The room just was like silent.
We got to do something about that.
No, but like you're saying, we're starved for intimacy. Yeah. And our structures reflect this value system where we don't need to relate to one another intimately. It's okay to just sit in a row and look at the back at someone's head, but there's actually something developing in us as a collective, as a Mormon church and body of Christ that is reaching out for something new. And it's exciting.
It is.
It's not about controversy. It's not about challenging authority. It's about listening into what everybody needs.
Yeah. You know? I mean, can't we de facto skip that part where you're putting up just more controversial ideas on a board? It's just another way to put an abstract idea on a board, right?
And there's a certain stage where just the controversy is like, that's really a lot of juice for people.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say it's at the late achiever stage where it's okay to have rows still, but it's not okay to not be able to disagree. I'm cool with the rows, but if you don't let me say that, like, I know more about church history than that manual, and I need to bring this perspective because I'm really upset about the dissonance, then those people will stop coming to church too.
Well, we teach. We have a little. My wife and I lead our church calling is we lead a little family relations group discussion group right now. Mm-hmm. It's smallish, you know, half a dozen couples. And we meet in our living room, not on Sunday, so you can wear shorts and T-shirts. You can wear whatever you want. And we get together and discuss, and then we go out to dinner or barbecue there or whatever. But we meet in a circle.
Yeah.
And the vulnerability and honesty that has, off, you know, maybe it's partly because we're not in a church classroom and we're just meeting as friends.
Yeah.
But we're talking about, like, gospel in action, growing in the gospel in relationship.
Yeah.
And it gets real, and it's just beautiful. And
I love it.
I think there's something to be learned about how we should meet as a people. It's not
for sure.
There's something wrong. It's not meeting, and we're getting too many people leaving. It's not filling their needs. So what do we need to do?
Yeah. No, this is good. I was at a study group a couple nights ago, and the topic was on literalism and science. Right, this great divide. And the intention was to be very inclusive of whoever comes, we're just going to make space to have a nice conversation about this topic and love each other. I could not believe within like 20 seconds of the study group beginning, I just felt my whole body split. I felt the room split, just saying the word literalist and science. And like the room was at subtle war. And it just happened so automatically. I just knew intuitively that we had stumbled upon this deep wound in the culture where, you know, if even the word when we say literalist, like, oh, you believe the Bible is literally true, some people think that's childish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, other people think this whole scientific enterprise that we can explain all of God's beautiful creation, you know, through mathematics and biology and chemistry, they think that's just ridiculous. So the room divides, and really a strong intention for that night and an intention we carry in our community as we gather. You ask about how we gather. I talk about it as a fundamental kindness towards all perspectives. And that's a developmental act to really hear a perspective, recognize a perspective, and to be kind towards it, whether you personally agree with it or not.
Which does not mean that you have to recognize that all perspectives are equally valid.
No, not at all.
You can still bring your own judgment to that.
Absolutely, exactly. In fact, you know, it's when we're able to actually be kind towards different perspectives that we're also able to prioritize perspectives and say, you know what, it's truer to love somebody than to hate somebody.
Yeah.
I accept that this person hates that person. I can see from their point of view, like if I were in that situation, I could see myself hating them. and I still privilege loving and forgiving somebody. Mm. But it's really a lifelong exercise in my experience. And, you know, moment to moment with every encounter, if we're honest with ourselves, we recognize some perspectives just sound like truth to us and other perspectives sound crazy or that person's uninformed or, you know, we have our reactions to perspectives and it's really an art. I've seen people do this really well, like just openness and a softness and a welcoming. My granddad did that to me.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a really good example.
Yeah.
Okay. What if we just focused? What if it became our focus to just talk about growing in the gospel? So it's really, if growth is what we're really interested in, a lot of these issues, the other night I was called by my home teaching family. I love them dearly, and one of them needed a blessing. And I came over and, you know, sat down with her and took her hand and knelt by the side of her chair. She's older and just connected really deeply and then gave her a blessing. And I have no idea how she feels about literalism and science. I don't care.
Right.
But she has this quality about her that's really beautiful. And I think it's evidence that she's grown throughout her life. And so some issues are just more important than other issues, right? So maybe that's something we need to just teach each other. I think, though, that you've modeled something. What do you do? What do you do in your little local gatherings where you teach mindfulness and develop? What's the quality of those gatherings that you think we may be able to bring to our church gatherings?
Well, yeah, to the extent that it's possible. I do this as much as I'm capable, and I am young and immature and growing. But to the extent that I can actually do it as a facilitator, I think as we get into these stages where it's not just assumed that everyone in the room thinks this, right? In fact, it's assumed that everybody thinks something else, and you're actually taking a risk by suggesting that, well, what if we were Mormon this way?
Yeah.
My experience is that that takes facilitation. It takes somebody to model the stage, the way of being. And because we all have all of the stages in our DNA, something in us sees it and responds to it, and it tastes delicious, and we wake up a little bit, right? When we see someone at the front of the room taking a comment that just is like totally from left field, it doesn't make any sense, we don't agree with it at all, and the facilitator takes it and like, thank you. That's really rich what you shared, and I can see how much that perspective means to you. Mm. You see someone model that, and you know, in the meantime, you're kind of in the crowd like, I can't believe you just let that fly. Yeah. Like, there's a really powerful facilitator role in all of this to be the kindness towards all perspectives, to make room for every person, every story.
Yeah. And how can you do that if you're not informed about the way people develop through life, through like these developmental stages? I don't know how you can really legitimately do that, because that's one thing that's really brought a lot of peace to me in my engagement with my Mormon community is seeing myself at a certain, I can very clearly remember what it felt when I thought that way and thought those same thoughts and that same perspective on the world.
Yep.
And how it served me well. I mean, it's not, and not in a, it sounds condescending, like, oh, I've moved past that, but I still have most of those things in me today, actually. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
It's at some level. So I mean, if you don't get that, then you just become impatient with everyone.
That's right.
Everybody's impatient with each other. So
yeah, that's right.
I don't know. That seems critical to me, is to understand these developmental growth stages.
It is, and the good news is that on a cognitive level, when we're exposed to the descriptions of the stages, we see this so much in our research. We see this so much at Pacific Integral, that when people are just exposed to the maps, they see themselves in them.
Yeah.
They realize like, oh yeah, that's me. Like, it's like when I read that article that John wrote in Sunstone.
Yeah.
I couldn't say it, but when I saw it staring back at me, it became this new moral conscience. Like, I need to live up to that. So to just learn the stages, to just read a description of them, it tends to awaken us to our own latent capacities developmentally. And then we have, you know, a whole lifetime to actually grow into them and draw from them and manifest them and bless the human family with them. But the great news is to just, you know, read about them, to just learn the concepts of this is what that stage looks like and find it in yourself. We can all do that.
On the way down here today, driving down from the Heber Valley down to KSL Studios here, and I was listening to conference talks, and I listened to two talks. One was by Elder Christofferson, and one was by Elder Palmer, who's kind of a new 70. I think he's from Australia. Sounded Australian.
Oh, cool. Anyway,
they actually talked about something that was their subject matter was really quite had a lot in common. Mm-hmm. They were addressing this generally the same subject. But it was so interesting to see the developmental language in that they used, like it was reflected in what they and the way they communicated that message. And for Elder Christofferson, it was very much let's kind of straighten out the world. We need to be bold and really straighten the world out. And which to me is sort of classical, expert and achiever kind of thing. You know, you've solidified your worldview. Now you need to go out and propound that worldview in a very effective way. And Elder Palmer took this kind of the same subject, teaching like how do we in a role where we're trying to affect the world in a positive way. He said the key to it is beholding and loving the other. And the developmental language manifests in both of those two talks. Now, I'm not saying that they're at different developmental levels. It may be that Elder Christofferson is meeting his people where they are.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
But I sense that there's something a little bit more to it.
I think so.
But the way they use language in addressing a very similar topic was so starkly different. And we need to see that in our culture and be okay with it, I guess. But also, I've heard many people since conference. Maybe it's just the people I hang out with. Maybe it says something more about the people I hang out with than the conference itself. But comment on Elder Palmer's talk and how good that felt as an invitation to engage in the world.
Yep.
And so, that's.
It gives me a lot of hope. There's no question that the leadership embodies a whole spectrum of the stages. And in some cases, it's a skillful use of developmental messaging. They're speaking exactly the way they need to the exact people they want to address. And in other cases, like all of us, I think our leaders are had by their development. They don't know they're speaking from a developmental perspective, just like we often don't. And to pop out of this, you know, perspective we assume to be the final truth. It's a really profound exercise in development. It cultivates humility. And when we speak from that place, you hear what your friends say. It's like, wow, that just felt really good.
Yeah. You know, I want to come back in our next session to a little bit more about this, about growth and development and how that's manifest in our church culture. And I'm going to ask you some provocative questions as well, including what role Jesus played through this spiritual journey of yours. the role of prayer in that, and some other topics about imagination and creativity in our culture. And so we'll come back to that next time we sit down.
Can't wait. Thanks, Bill.